On this episode of Baseball Barbecast, we talk about Denzel Clark's catch. Who is Denzel Clark? Why is he making all these amazing catches? Is this one of the greatest catches of all time? That and so much more, including special guest Chris Burke, ESPN broadcaster, joins us to preview the Men's College World Series and also talk about one of the greatest catches of all time that he was in the building for. Finally, we talk about Roman Anthony's Major League debut and Shohei Ohtani getting oh so close to pitching for the Dodgers. All that on this episode of Baseball Barbercast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world who knows that for a real home run robbery, you got to get a crew together. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and it's not a heist unless you have 13 other people.
Interesting. Now I'm thinking about, like, you know, the opening scene of The Dark Knight, and it's like, all right, how can I apply this to robbing a home run? I don't know. I guess we should ask Denzel Clark, because I feel like we're going to be watching him do this for the next 10 years.
That is our main topic. On this episode of Baseball Barbercast, we will talk about the Denzel Clark home run robbery, give a specific play the shine it deserves. We have a special guest, Chris Burke of ESPN and the Houston Astros and the University of Tennessee, and as we learn, not the Texas Rangers. And then at the very end of the show, we will chat about Ohtani maybe returning to pitching, the call-up of Roman Anthony, and why I am furious and disappointed in the Los Angeles Dodgers. But let's begin with the catch heard around the world. That is our opener.
Denzel Clark.
Who he?
Before we get to this play, let's introduce the main character. Because this is probably a name, a player that a lot of people read, learned, heard, watched for the very first time when he made this unbelievable catch in Anaheim earlier this week. So who is this man? Whose man's? Denzel Clark, 25-year-old.
The Nailers. The Nailers man. Yeah. Cousin.
Oh, yes. He is a cousin, and that is important as he is a Canadian, which is cool. Not only is he Canadian, his mother was a Canadian Olympian. Well, that helps if we want to have some athleticism in the family. Let's have your mom be an Olympian. That works out well.
What'd she do? What type of Olympics?
I believe she was like a, I don't know about like heptathlete. Let's see. I should, but like, it's not, this was not, here we go. Donna Smelly Clark, track and field, made the Canadian national team at age 19, set the Canadian record for the long jump at the time, since been broken. But yeah, 1984 Olympics, represent her home country competing as a heptathlete. So I was right. So how about that?
The hops are in the family.
That, yes, indeed. But this is... this is something special, folks. So anyway, Denzel Clark, how does he get to the A's? He was a fourth round pick, 2021, out of Cal State Northridge. And he was just the kind of guy where it's like, well, he's obviously an amazing athlete. If he can like learn how to play baseball at a high level, he is going to be an impact major league player. And while the offense, I mean, he was a good hitter in college, has kind of taken some time to come together, what has been clear essentially since he got into pro ball is that the dude can play center field. His combination of speed, coordination, hops, just all of it, just watching him run in center field, one of the coolest things about this catch as we dig into the specifics, something that Sam Miller wrote about at his wonderful Substack Pebble Hunting, which I recommend, is that even in his, 16 games of Major League Baseball, he had already made or nearly made like five other unbelievable catches, and that this was just building up to this moment where he would scale the wall and make one of the greatest catches we've ever seen. And like we said, this is just 2 or 3 weeks of Major League play. But this is what Denzel Clark's been known for in the minors, and now he is already going to be known for this in the Major Leagues. Again, offense not going so great. He has 31 strikeouts and one walk. But who cares if you're already the greatest defensive center fielder anybody's ever seen, which is an interesting conversation at this time in our sport when we have a lot of amazing center field defense. That's pretty cool. So let's talk about the catch itself and then let's go big picture.
It's a top five catch in baseball history, in my opinion.
All right.
It is remarkable in its uniqueness as well. So this was in the bottom of the first on Monday evening. The A's and the Angels. Who would have thought that baseball history would have been made in this game? But it was. As Nolan Shanuel. Is it Shanuel or Shanuel?
Shanuel. Yeah.
Nolan Shanuel. Yeah. Usually doesn't hit the ball that far. He did this time.
I will say, he's so perfect for this. If I had to pick someone to hit it barely over the wall, it would be Nolan Shanuel.
He scoops a splitter out to dead center field at Angel Stadium. Denzel Clark ranges back, leaps his belt even with the top of the wall, even and over the top of the wall, full extension, snags the ball. His torso folds over the fence as he hangs on. He swings his body from left to right as he corrals the rock and drops back down to earth from space. And disbelief is the word that takes the day. A's pitcher, Grant Holman. Grant?
That's right. You nailed it.
We go way back. Hands on his head in a joyous surrender cobra. The camera pans to Shanuel, who looks for long enough that he will be remembered forever. Like, there is a version of this, in my opinion, where he's not as much of a main character. But his look is anger, disbelief, just confusion, really. And it stays on him for long enough that he is enough of a character in the play. But of course, the main man here is Denzel Clark, because it's just a remarkable thing to watch. It really is.
So people were quick to point out that Mike Trout made a very similar catch early in his career against the Mariners of Seattle. Jesus Montero clobbering a ball to center, and he made a similar style catch where he scaled the wall and got over it. Because most home run robberies feature the glove is basically the only thing that is over the wall. Is that fair
to say?
Right,
like forearm. That, sometimes you get
maybe
forearm.
Maybe some percentage of the arm is over, but most home run robberies, that is what they look like. Some version of that. There are parts of this video, and this is true for Trout too, where you can pause it, and as you mentioned, the belt is over the fence. And in Clark's case, what makes his almost more dramatic and you know, visually shocking to watch is kind of the move that he does on top of the wall after the ball is in his glove. There's a moment where it almost looks like he's going to fall over the fence, which when you're talking about a fence of this size is hard to wrap your mind around. But then he kind of spins around and wants to show everyone that he caught the ball and seems to start that process while he's still on top of the wall. Like, you pause it and it's one of those like, oh, you know, record scratch, how did I end up in this situation? But truly, if you pause it at certain parts, you're like, how did he get to this spot, let alone catch the ball? Forget that there is a catch involved. It's like, how did he physically end up in this position on top of this wall is hard to wrap your mind around.
It's
so amazing. I just think, again, he's made, like, the catch he made against, I think it was Baltimore last week, where it was a full speed, this was not a home run, Rob, but it was a full speed sprint into the left center field gap, and he crashes into the wall. I mean, that one in some ways is more amazing just because of how much more ground he covers, but also it's just a different genre. But that's the thing, like, he just has all the skills you would want in a center fielder to make this play. Now, you say it's the top five of all time. I you know, maybe. I wouldn't be surprised, because it's certainly one of the best that I've seen in my, you know, 10 plus years doing this. But what are the other ones that stand out? The Trout one stands out. Trout has another one, of course, very famous against the Orioles. Now, the difference between that one where he robs J.J. Hardy, the difference with that one, that also involves some serious height, but the wall is much shorter. So while he also gets very high over the wall, he's not climbing the wall. He's just leaping. The coordination that is required for a catch like this, and this goes back to the original Trout one too, and Clark, it's not a simple thing to time and then leap. And there's just so many things involved with the actual climbing of the wall that's different than just jumping. And that's why this is in the inner circle for sure.
Gary Matthews Jr. is the only one in my mind that goes above this. Simply because Gary Matthews Jr. is a combination of this play and the Willie Mays over the shoulder catch, where his back is completely to the field of play and he is tracking the ball over his head at the same time, somehow inexplicably. Clark, as he is running towards the wall, again, I'm not trying to chew through this, he's not running full speed. Like, he's running full speed for maybe like 10 feet. He's mostly tracking the ball, understanding, and that's impressive on its own, right? Like, he knows he doesn't need to run full speed for the entire time to make this play.
Sure.
And that, in fact, moderating his momentum towards the wall is the right move so that he can get up and over.
Yeah. But here's another thing about this. There are more balls that are robbable than even get close to attempted to. So, like, I guess the way I'm trying to phrase it is, like, there you have to be a certain level of athlete and brave to attempt this. There are a lot of center fielders or certainly corner outfielders where you'll see the ball land right beyond the fence and you're like, oh, not that it's easy, but there are definitely times when I'm just like, why didn't you at least jump, right? Like, you see the ball go right over. And for this, it requires a level of audacity to attempt it in the first place, let alone complete it. And that's part of why you have to grade this one so high, is just the level of difficulty and just the willingness to attempt it. Because there are a lot of home runs that are wall scrapers that no one even attempts to catch. There was one, I mean, we see ones all the time where not even just like a Jose Canseco clanks off the glove and becomes a home run. There are a lot of guys that do try it. I can think of Joe Adell in this same ballpark. I feel like has had like four or five where he jumps up and tries to catch it and doesn't. Either it goes off his glove or he just misses. There are guys that do try it. And for Clark to have this already happen. And then the other great thing too is it's like when you have the eye test match up with the advanced stats, which are already telling us. I mean, for him to already be at 8 outs above average playing like 2 weeks of games is impossible. That's a rate that doesn't really compute whatsoever. And then you kind of, when you look at that leaderboard, you kind of realize where we're at now is center field defense, which is really cool. And I can't speak to what outs above average would have been in 1996 when we had some of those, you know, superstars running around. But I do feel very fortunate the level of center field defense that we're watching right now. And the fact that we're kind of getting new characters this frequently is also cool, right? Remember, even 2 years ago, we were like, well, Brenton Doyle is the best we've ever seen. He was grading out as good as we've seen in years and years and years. And this year, for whatever reason, Brenton Doyle is like merely pretty good. And all these other guys are surging past him. We have PCA now. Of course, Julio continues to grade better and better every single season. Dalton Varsho has made some unbelievable plays in center, and his story is amazing.
Harris.
And now we had Michael Harris, of course, absolutely. Rafaela in Boston's been tremendous. So we just have some remarkable athletes out here. But Clark, his physical abilities are, I just know we're going to get to see more of this. And I think that by itself is pretty exciting.
Yeah, if you go by OAA, I mean, this is an unbelievable thing. Outs above average. Ready for this? So PCA is one, Rafaela is two, Julio is three. All of those guys have played between 540 and 599 innings, right? Clark is fourth in OAA, and he has played 134 innings, right? He has been more valuable as a defensive center fielder than Michael Harris in like a third of the innings, a fourth of the innings.
Yeah. He's made that many difference-making plays.
Exactly.
Is pretty much what that is telling us. And Victor Scott's another one that's up there. But Clark, because of just the kind of athleticism that he has, there's different styles of great outfield defense. Sometimes it is, in his case, he has maybe both, right? He has the technique, but also the physical abilities to get to more balls than the average guy and then to make the catch, to make the jump, to make the leap, to climb the wall. Then there's other guys that are just so good that it just looks easy. Sometimes PCA. That's PCA, right? I mean, not that he doesn't have some diving catches too, but his routes and his speed are so good that he doesn't even really need to make diving catches oftentimes. So he has that going for them. Julio's honestly kind of at that point as well. So it's cool that you can have different kind of flavors of it, I would say.
Also, last point here. The center fielder for the Sacramento Athletics before Denzel Clark was J.J. Bladé, who is last. He is last on the list this year. He has been statistically the worst defensive center fielder in the world. And they were like, let's go the other direction. And then they now have the best defensive center fielder in the world. Yeah. What a juxtaposition. All right.
Yes.
That was...
Let us know. Let us know. Well, what other catches are we forgetting? I know there's some Jim Edmonds ones. I know there are some circumstantial ones like saving a no-hitter, perfect game, stuff like that. And that's all fair if you want to grade catches. But if you are stripping the game scenario and you are just judging what physically occurred, this is absolutely one of the greatest of all time. And I feel very comfortable saying as much. And because of what it's been so far, I look forward to the next one because I think Denzel Clark's going to be doing this a lot more than anybody else.
It's probably already happened. All right, let's take a break. And when we get back, we will talk college baseball with Chris Burke. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We're glad to be joined by one of the few individuals on this planet who I think might enjoy this sport more than we do. It is Chris Burke of ESPN, the Houston Astros, the Texas Rangers, the Colorado Rockies, and most importantly, University of Tennessee. Chris.
When did I play for Texas and Colorado? I forgot that part of my life.
I thought you did play
Arizona
for Texas
and San Diego, but I mean, you know, ish.
Nailed it. He crushed it.
Well, thankfully, we will not be talking about Chris Burke's major league career. We're going to be talking about Chris Burke's job covering college baseball. We have arrived. The road to Omaha has led to this week where 8 teams will descend on the great state of Nebraska and try and win a national championship. Chris Burke, we're going to keep this conversation pretty broad here, as we know that not everyone listening to this is necessarily a college baseball sicko like us three. But you sell this sport better than most, and so you felt like a perfect guest to come on and join us. So I know you're heading to Omaha here soon. You're going to be on the other broadcast for ESPN. Big picture here, what are you most excited about this year's field that's heading to Omaha?
I'm most excited about how wide open it is. Now, I do think Arkansas and LSU are the cream of the crop, but I also think that we've learned a lot from this tournament that is parity kind of reigns this year in college baseball. I certainly didn't see that coming, but you have 8 teams from 7 different conferences, and you have a Missouri Valley representative in Murray State, which is one of the great stories that we've seen here in recent memory. You have a team in Oregon State that is a team without a conference currently. That's a pretty
– Who needs one?
Who needs one?
Yeah, who needs a conference?
And so, you know, we had so many either upsets or near upsets throughout the course of this tournament that I'm super excited to see how it all plays out on the field. You know, like I said, I think Arkansas and LSU are the favorites. By the same token, they're on the same side of the bracket. So I really feel like the left side of the bracket could be just a blast, and it's really anybody's guess.
So when we had your colleague Mike Rooney on to help us preview the college season, something that he talked about was how the influx of NIL money and the transfer portal seemed to be bringing more talent from mid-major programs into the Power Four, and more specifically the ACC and the SEC. That makes sense, right? Now that money matters more than ever before, the more talented players are going to end up at the places with the most resources. So you would think, based upon that information, that we would end up with, you know, 5 SEC teams and 3 ACC teams in Omaha. I believe last year was 4-4.
Yeah,
4 ACC, 4 SEC. Why do you think we've had so much parity this year? Is it a product of baseball just being inherently random as a sport?
Well, I think there's a couple answers to that. Number one, I do think the talent has largely filtered its way up to the major conferences, and I think the draft will show that. But teams are not made of talent alone, and there's a lot bigger picture to dissect than just who has the most draft picks. And so I think two things can be true at once. You know, I saw something going into the regionals that there of the top 150 prospects for the draft, 63 of them were going to be playing in regionals, and 31 of them were from the SEC. So half of the college top 150 prospects are in one league. So that is true. They have aggregated the most star-studded players. But what was also proven to be true is other teams, I'll take Murray State as a great example, have used the portal to find themselves better players that might not be top 150 prospects, but are clearly valuable and effective college baseball players. And so I think sometimes we equate the portal and NIL to the same thing. It's not the same thing. There is the portal that is this huge pool of players that are to some degree available to everybody. We know the top of it is going to be to the schools that have the NIL. And so you've got this, I don't know, 10% of players, maybe 5% of players that are in the portal to make money, and good for them. What a country, right? But you have like this 90, 95% group of players that just want a different opportunity. They want a new coaching staff. They want a new situation. They think they can move up and better their lot. Maybe they need to move down so that they can play, whatever the case might be. Maybe they want to go to a different part of the country. And so you're seeing all different kinds of schools use the portal to their advantage. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're paying players to do it.
That's really interesting. And you're right. Murray State's a great example for that. Jordan and I yesterday, because we're sickos, went through and looked at how many transfers each Omaha team has. And you look at a team like Murray State, their starting catcher, Will Vierling, cousin of Matt Vierling, was at Louisville. And you would think that transferring, that would be a transfer down, right? Or their number two hitter, Dustin Mercer, was at Virginia Tech. That's a Power Four school. Going from there to Murray State is a transfer down, but there are the top schools are bringing in more talent than they play in a way. And so these other programs are being intelligent by just kind of scooping up the guys who fall through the cracks.
And their best player, right? Jonathan Hogarth, was at La Tech and basically didn't get to play. And he's become a, you know, kind of a sensation here in the postseason. So yeah, that part of it is, you know, it's funny. We were watching game seven as a family. And my wife said, oh, you know, I'm in love with this Murray State team because, you know, they're not all about the transfer portal. And I said, hold on, babe.
What?
Again, it's just a very common thing for the common fan to equate NIL and transfer portal. And they are two different things at the highest level of the sport.
Sure. But let's actually, let's talk about this quickly first. The teams that are using NIL in Omaha, right? Because you say those are two different things, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Right. That's right.
Right. So
and they still have an advantage.
You take a look at Arkansas.
Those teams clearly have an advantage, just like the Dodgers and the Yankees clearly have an advantage. That just doesn't mean they're going to win the whole thing or even make it to the end of the dance.
Right. You know, you look at Arkansas, whose number one pitcher, Zach Root, was ECU. That's probably a kid who got some point to hop from ECU to Fayetteville.
You could tell that most of and LSU is the same way, although it's not quite as extreme as maybe in recent seasons. I think the element of I'm so glad you distinguish the difference between NIL and the portal and how different teams are using it in different ways. And from a player perspective, I'm so glad you point that out. And that's so true, right? That guys are finding places to flourish, whether that means, you know, going from a mid-major to become a first round pick in the case of, you know, Vahiva Aloy or, you know, Iva Arquette at Oregon State. I mean, I know he came from Washington, but still same kind of thing, raising your profile. The part that I'm most fascinated by, and I'd love your perspective on this, is from a coaching standpoint and a roster building standpoint and a like a clubhouse chemistry standpoint. This is what is so amazing to me about college baseball nowadays. I understand all the players and coaches and teams are acting rationally, but from like a cohesive unit, this is what is so interesting to me. I know your alma mater, Tennessee, is, I think, a great example of that. I know they did not make it to Omaha, but for them to be as good as they were this year with essentially an entirely new team because of the portal, because of the number of guys that they had drafted, there's a lot of things that go into that. You look at LSU, right? Oh, they just won the College World Series 2 years ago. There's one player that was on that team that's still around. And part of that is because of, new recruits and everything. But I'm curious what you've heard from coaches about having success in this era of college baseball when your roster is changing.
Yeah,
this often.
I think I've had some really interesting conversations around that. One, every staff handles some of these things different. There's some staffs that I think make a hard, fast rule. Like I heard one staff this year say, you are not allowed to talk about what you make. And if you do, that breaks a team rule and you're subject to then lose what you make. So they can make these things team rules, right? And now you and I both know if it's the wrong person who says that, then he probably isn't going to lose his NIL. But I think it can become a very divisive thing in the locker room, depending on how it's handled and honestly, how the players that make the most money perform and lead. I mean, you guys cover Major League Baseball. It's no different. There's a pretty famous person that has been getting a lot of heat for how much money he's making and the way he is or isn't playing the game. Correct me if I'm wrong, right? And that can really be a problem. And the problem really becomes how do you discipline a player who's making that much money? Because it becomes a little bit of an elephant in the room, right? So I think in the college world.
And it's not just the elephant in the room, Berkey, because then that kid can just leave, right? So because everything is essentially a one-year contract, if the kid's not happy or is being disciplined or gets benched or like the player coach relationship is so much more fraught and fragile than it has ever been before.
It is, but I would say in baseball, this is probably where it's different than football and basketball. Baseball, the draft is so much bigger that for the most part, if you get a big time portal kid, he's getting drafted.
But now let's bring this back to the teams that we have in Omaha, right? And when even from a coaching perspective, the fact that you have an interesting range of coaches, some that have been in Omaha a bunch, some that have been in Omaha, but not in 10 years, in the year 10 plus in the case of, John Savage at UCLA, you have some first year head coaches, right? And Kevin Schnall at Coastal Carolina taking over for the legendary Gary Gilmore. And then, right, Dan Skirka, who's already kind of assumed this cult figure personnel just because of whatever. Anytime you're going to lead a team that like Murray State to Omaha, you're going to get that reputation for well deserved. But in terms of the on field product in this era of college baseball, what do you see any trends among these coaches? And Chip Hale also fascinates me as the rare one who spent most of his time in professional baseball before, taking over Arizona. What among the coaches in Omaha,
there's a lot of really good feel-good stories from whether it's the small school Dan Skirka, who may or may not cut the grass of the field. I've heard different reports of that. But he seems to be a very special leader. I mean, when you listen to his players talk about him, it's very clear that he's difference making influence in their life. And so that's really cool. You've got guys like Dan McDonald who, and thank you for getting us off the portal NIL conversation, but, if you're being honest, I think guys like John Savage and Dan McDonald were sitting there wondering in this world, when I look up and feel like I see a lot of the haves getting to Omaha every year, do I still have a place at the top of the sport? And so to see them get back is awesome. Chip Hale, who Jake, I played under Chip when I was with the Diamondbacks. So just reminding you that I didn't.
You were there. Yeah. You played for them. I know that.
Anyway, Chip and I hit it off. He was the infield coach. I was a super utility guy, but, Yeah, I played, I might have played more in the outfield than I did in the infield, but I was an infielder by heart. So he and I spent a lot of time. You guys are getting a kick out of this, and sorry for this rabbit trail, but Adam Everett, in my mind, started the shift. When I got to Arizona, I spent a lot of time talking to Chip about, hey, man, how come we don't move our infielders? And how come we, you know, and this was on the early days of analytics. So Chip and I'm really excited to see Chip and to catch up with him. But you're right. It's a rare coach in today's college world that can go from pro ball to the college game and flourish. But they got it going there at Arizona. So excited to see them. And then you got Coastal Carolina, who I actually really enjoyed Kevin Schnall's, I don't know how you phrase it, but support of his program. But Kevin Schnall, I don't know if you heard him, but he was like, hey, man, we're not a Cinderella story. Like, we are a host. We won the national championship in 2016. We're a top 10 regional appearance over the last however many years. Like, Coastal Carolina is a big boy program. And I kind of dug that because good for him. Like, they are, you know? So anyway, there is a bunch of different. And then Mitch Canham taking a proud Oregon State team back. And then, of course, you got the big boys. Dave Van Horn, can he win the first one? Can Jay Johnson, you know, can Jay Johnson establish himself as the only coach besides Skip Bertman to win multiple titles at LSU, right? So I think there's storylines abound. And we got a whole bunch of first-round picks from a player standpoint. So take
your pick. Let's talk about that. Yeah. Let's talk about that. Like, who on the field are you most excited to see in person? I know that you've probably seen a number of the SEC guys at various points this year, whether that's Vahiva Aloy at Arkansas, whether that's Jared Jones at LSU. Maybe besides, like, the LSU-Arkansas SEC guys, like, who are you really amped to get
eyes on? I want to see Ivar Arquette. I can't wait to watch him up close and personal. I really want to see him move. You know, it's a 6'5" shortstop, okay? I want to see him move. I want to see him get to the ground. I want to see him charge a ball. You know, as somebody that's done the draft for the last 5 years, like, I'm excited to kind of evaluate the way he moves in person. It looks like he's going to be the first position player off the board in the draft. So he's probably number one that I'm most excited to see. Caden Bodine, catcher for Coastal Carolina. Hit a couple home runs the other day against Auburn. He's right there with Ryder Helfrich as far as pitch presentation. I mean, he can really catch and throw. And so I'm excited to watch him work and to see what he's capable of. Arizona shortstop Mason White, as Rooney likes to say, he spends the whole dollar. Like, he takes a hack. And so for a kid who's 5'10" and 180, I'm like, man, I want to see how that operation works in person. So that's probably the short list of kids that I haven't got my own eyeballs on that I think America and casual baseball fans and Bodine and Arquette are both going to be first rounders. I'm not exactly sure where Mason White fits in there, but if you're a Major League Baseball fan, like, tune in to watch those dudes amongst others. Yeah. But those are some exciting players to watch.
And the two that I'll add, and these guys are both for next year's draft, are Rock Chalowski at UCLA, who we're talking, you know, top five could be potential next year. Could be 1-1. Like, he's really interesting because he stayed at UCLA when you would imagine that there were financial offers for him to go play at an SEC school, not in the Big Ten. And then the other one I'm fascinated in is Zion Rose at Louisville, because, I mean, if you're talking big league physicality, I mean, that dude is a man playing.
He looks like an outside linebacker.
Big pop.
And at one point was a catcher. So that Louisville team, Eddie King Jr., Jake Monroe, like, from the jump, I live here in Louisville, so I'm pretty familiar with their roster. Matt Klein, like, that, I was telling everybody in the offseason, that team has Omaha caliber dudes. Like, they have real. Tague Davis at first base led the country in home runs for freshmen. The question was always going to be with Louisville, can they pitch? And I will tell you, Patrick Forbes could be this year's Cade Horton. It is as special of a fastball as there is certainly left in the event, but maybe just in general. And if Patrick Forbes goes out there and strikes out 12 against Oregon State, he might move up 10 spots in the draft. He's got that yeah. special of a fastball, two-way player, crazy athletic. It's still a little bit raw as a prospect, honestly. But that I really feel like, and again, I probably, you know, deserve to be kicked in the shins for saying this by the Coastal people because they've only won 23 straight games. But I feel like the winner of Oregon State and Louisville is going to represent that side of the bracket. So I'm happy to be wrong if that doesn't play out at all. But it feels like those are the two most talented rosters, even though yeah. I will say Arizona and Coastal are right there. But I really think the winner is going to come out of that game.
I will, I'll wrap with this just on some of those players. Arquette, I'm excited for you to see. I saw him opening weekend in Arizona make some amazing plays at shortstop, and you like your mind can't quite comprehend mm-hmm. it because he is enormous. Like he talked about big league physicality, and then watching him play shortstop is special. Forbes, one of my favorite pitchers in the draft. Very excited to see hopefully him perform on that stage. I know it was kind of uneven during the spring, but the talent is definitely there. The one other guy I wanted to mention that just hasn't mentioned is an SEC guy. One of the biggest breakouts of the season is Charles Davalon mm-hmm. At Arkansas. He's just someone, another transfer guy came in from Florida Gulf Coast. But he's someone that I feel like really got a lot of people's attention in the SEC this year. And I'd love to know if you had that.
Chucky
well.
D, as I like to call him, Brian Giles is the comp. I mean, it's like number 24, open stance, toe tap, world-class pitch recognition, world-class swing decisions, hitting 470 yep. off left-handers, which just boggles your brain. And has yep. only struck out, I think, like 22 times. So, you know, Arkansas.
More yeah, walks and strikeouts. Probably could yeah, be playing
he
center.
Could be.
I mean, he's.
He's not the fastest. Yeah, he's
really,
not
really
the
talented. Played some infield.
Would be your only knock yeah. on him from a draft perspective, but very modern in that it's the short armed, smaller framed, but like elite bat to ball. It's a little bit Travis Bazana without quite the twitchiness. From a frame standpoint,
yep.
But he is an awesome, yep. awesome player.
And then I think the last team we just didn't really touch on that much, but I think is important because they are such a big deal, and we did just see them win the national championship 2 years ago. Is LSU? Now there's a lot of names you can mention on this team, right? Cade Anderson and Anthony Ianson, their top two pitchers, are both. Cade Anderson might be a top five pick. Ianson might be a first rounder. A lot of interesting hitters to key in on because it's such a different lineup. I'm curious what stands out to you about this LSU team.
It's the pitchers for sure. The hitting is. The only concern, like what's the difference between LSU and Arkansas? I feel better about Arkansas's offense. If you watch LSU
Agreed.
In the SEC tournament and LSU in a couple games in their regional, you're going, oh no, where does their offense come from? But then if you watch LSU in the super regional, you're like, how does this team not win the national championship? And so it just feels like their offense is a little more up and down than Arkansas's. And so that would be the concern. Not as much thump, not as many, so we get to Omaha and everybody says, well, the home run's not as much in play, but I would argue that the home run almost becomes more important because the 3-run homer now has a chance to be way more impactful in a 5-3 game
yeah.
than in a 10-8 game. And so the amount of people you can send up to bat that actually are capable of getting it out of Charles Schwab Field to me becomes even more of a storyline. And it feels like to me, LSU has fewer options than Arkansas as far as hitting the ball out of that ballpark throughout their lineup.
Sure,
so
yeah.
That being said, Jake Brown's really done a nice job. Obviously, Derek Curiel, the freshman for LSU, there's people that could see him being a high-end first rounder in a couple years. And Jared Jones can hit the ball out foul pole to foul pole. So They you know, Hernandez, the catcher, yeah. has the type of juice to hit the ball out of that ballpark. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying LSU doesn't have options. I'm just saying they have fewer options than Arkansas. And so that's why I would give Arkansas a slight advantage over LSU.
I like the idea. Yeah, LSU doesn't have as many guys who can hit it out of Schwab, but they have Jared Jones who could hit
that's
it out
right.
of two Schwabs.
That's right. His name is Bear. So,
we saw LSU in person Skeens' junior year. in Round Rock. And I'll never forget seeing Jared Jones in person. Like, there are certain ball players, I'm sure you had this experience playing in the big leagues, like certain ball players, you just remember seeing them in person, where the physicality, I had this experience with Dellin Betances when I first saw him in person. I was like, holy crap. And Jared Jones for LSU, their big boy first baseman, like, he is that type of physical player where he should just, like, he should be a defensive end.
Yeah.
Like, he should be a bouncer. Right. And he just gets to hold a baseball bat instead. And that's good for the rest of us. So my last question is, I know you remain neutral on the broadcast, but if you're speaking to a casual fan, right, someone with no dog in the fight, who should they latch on to? Who is the team here or the couple of teams here where if you're coming into this completely blind that you would recommend putting your chips down?
Well, which one? Who's the fan favorite or who should they pick to win the whole thing?
Fan favorite. Chips is... Emotional chips.
Well, I mean,
emotional chips.
Murray State would be the easy answer there. I think if you're,
yeah, come on.
If you're anti everything that the establishment feels like it's headed towards, which is the haves and the have nots being split, then you want to root for Murray State. I mean, that's clear. It's a bunch of grinders, a bunch of kids that, you know, probably get dressed in the parking lot on their way into the field. Like I actually have a personal relationship with a couple of those kids. Dom Decker, I've coached since he was 12 years old. I'll tell you about the trash can drill that he mastered one day. He's their second baseman. You want to talk about a story. He hits cleanup. He has zero home runs.
This is the magic of the Missouri Valley.
Now he's hitting 360. So give my guy some love. He can hit. He just doesn't hit it out of the ballpark. Now he'll probably hit three homers in Omaha. It'll be great. And Nick Shuddy was a great high school quarterback. He's their ace. He's another Louisville, Kentucky kid. So I just think, you know, the whole Murray State thing is magical. They really do remind me a lot of Oral Roberts from a couple years ago. You know, star center fielder in Hogarth, star closer in Kellam. You guys probably remember the Oral Roberts guys that were their center fielder and closer. I'm drawing a blank. There you go.
Yeah, Cade Denton.
There you
Denton
go.
And Jonah Cox. Yeah, now those guys were more, they were like real draft prospects with respect to the Murray State guys. But I would say that this Murray State team is even more physical offensively.
They are. They're deeper. They're deeper than the Oral Roberts team. Offensively.
Yeah, deeper,
but I would say that Kellam and Hogarth have probably played their way into being draft picks. They might not be.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. Also, Oral Roberts won a game. This is also important, right? I mean,
they almost won two.
I said this the other day. I think it would be more surprising if Murray State got swept than that they won a game, honestly, just based on what I've seen. And by the way, their closer, Graham Kellam, was on the bottom of the dog pile and had to get up and get another out. So if that doesn't earn you dude points, I can't help you. So Murray State has to be the emotional favorite pick.
Before we ask you about the greatest catch of all time, I do want listeners to understand specifically what Berkey's talking about. In the third game of the Super Regionals, Duke versus Murray State, one run game, I believe, maybe one two run game, in the ninth, and one run game. There's like a weird obstruction play that on a double play, like takeout slide situation. Ump calls the runner and the batter runner out, ends the game, ends the series. Murray State on to Omaha. They run out of the dugout. They dog pile. Play gets reviewed and overturned. The correct call, to be clear, correctly overturned. They got to undog pile, get back out there, lower the heart rate, get the final out. They get it on a little
dribbler. I think it helps that Graham Kellam doesn't have a heart rate. I think that's helpful because he just stands. If you guys watched game 7 of their regional, when they were up 11-3 and freak almost stuff. Lost the thing, nobody with a heartbeat could have stood out there and done what and performed the way Graham Kellam did. So that kid, he's on my all dude team.
Yeah. What is already dead cannot die, Berkey.
Well said.
So that's Maurice. Okay, so we have to finish though with something topical. We began the show with this, and we needed your take because you are uniquely qualified to talk about one of the greatest catchers in baseball history. And that is, as we referenced earlier, the Gary Matthews Jr. catch in Texas, in Arlington.
Where you played.
Going back, doing a pirouette on the wall, and somehow coming down with the out. You were on the Houston Astros in 2000.
I think it was six.
Was this five or six?
Six.
Six. Six. When this happened, you were there. What was your perspective on this play? And do you think the Denzel Clark catch
was better? I always tell people, like, I feel like my memory's pretty good on this stuff, but please go check the box score. I'm pretty sure I was on deck. Mike Lamb hits a ball to.
Okay, so let's start here. Pretty sure is
okay.
Not quite right. That's why you're right. Pretty sure and not definitely sure. I believe this was actually the one game you were sitting in.
I know I was right there on the edge of the dugout.
This is the one you.
Okay.
I'm sure you were. You played the day before and the day after, but okay. I do not believe you were in this game.
Maybe you went out on deck. Maybe you were out there.
I was standing right next to our manager when it happened. That's why I feel like maybe I was in the hole, but I guess I didn't. I had a collision with Willie Tavares the first game of that series, so that's probably maybe why I didn't play in the second game, even though I'm sure I was not happy about not playing in the second game. Anyway, back to the actual question. So I'm standing there. Mike Lamb, we're winning, right? What's the score? We're up. We're having a nice day.
You ended up winning this game.
Yeah, we're having a great day. So everybody's happy. Yeah. It's late in the game. Mike Lamb's having a monster game. He destroys a ball to center field. Mike's kind of my guy. Mike and I had this interesting thing where we oftentimes kind of platooned for each other, even though we didn't play the same position. So against left-handers, a lot of times I would play left and Berkman would go play first and Mike would sit. And against right-handers, I would come out. Berkman would go play left. You see what I'm saying? We had this kind of weird platoon thing. Obviously, Berkman wasn't going to go out of the lineup. So he and Mike and I were kind of – so we were kind of buddies.
Lance was pretty good
at baseball. So anyway, Mike's having a great day. I'm super pumped. He's launching balls. He kills this – and he was a Ranger. So it's always cool to play good against your former team. So he bombs the ball to dead center field. Looks like he's going to have season best kind of game, and Gary Matthews Jr. has a beat on this ball, and Gary was a uber rangy, acrobatic, you know, kind of throwback Devin White, Andrew Jones, Kenny Lofton, Ken Griffey Jr. kind of acrobat in center field, and he scales the wall with his back to the field and catches this thing six or seven feet over the wall by how long and rangy he is. And there's nothing you could do but just be in awe. Like, your jaw drops. You can't believe that somebody's physically capable of making a play like that. And I had a similar reaction to Clark's catch, a similar reaction. I would say that just as a baseball nerd, I thought Gary Matthews Jr. – I would love to see the stat cast on this. I thought Gary Matthews Jr. ran a little farther, and it felt like the degree of difficulty was a little higher just because his back was completely to the field when he caught the ball. So
yes, that's the part about the Matthews one that makes it look so different. And the fact that we had the parallel of the Clark and the Trout one that he made, you know, earlier in his career, both made the moment that much cooler. But also it was like, well, we have sort of seen this. Doesn't make it any less impressive, but we have seen a catch that looks like this. And by the way, I mean, again, maybe you weren't in the game, but you nailed it. I mean, to this point, Mike Lamb's got a double homer and a triple. And so this would have been his fourth extra base hit of the game if he had this. And instead, Gary Matthews said, no, not so fast.
Arguably kind of a victimless crime.
No, terrible take. That's a terrible take. I was just about to say this.
Mike Lamb slept well.
Here's what I'll tell you that night. Bagwell and I were texting about this the other day. We used to have a saying called salvage. Okay, so like, it didn't matter what you were in your last at bat. If you didn't make an out, you didn't even have to get a hit. But if you didn't make an out, we would scream out salvage. Okay, so if you're 0 for 4, three strikeouts, and got hit by a pitch in your fifth at bat, we'd be like, salvage! Like, and you would honestly be on the bus. Like, well, at least I didn't go 0 for 5. Yeah. You know what I mean? But if you were having a monster day and made an out in your last at bat, you could somehow be ticked off. Like, and so I'm telling you, Mike and I were like, we were buds. He was not overly happy after that game. Like, yes, at the end of the day, you had dinner, you had three hits. you had three extra base hits, whatever RBIs. But like yeah, you're sitting dude, there going, yeah. bro, I could have had another homer and three RBIs. And when it comes to arbitration, Jake, that matters. That's real
that's
money.
Joe, that's that so real true. Money.
Sure. No such thing as a victimless crime.
That's like the opposite of salvage. That's the kick in the shins.
Hey, but the other interpretation is he was a single away from the cycle and he got greedy.
It's his fault.
He tried to hit another homer.
Yeah,
he could have just dumped one over the
second baseman. I know this is a baseball nerd podcast, and I know you guys are ready to get rid of me, so I'll finish with this. Connor Jackson in 2008, okay?
Yes.
You can look this up. Connor Jackson in 2008.
We're
facing
legend.
The Padres,
of course.
And Greg Maddux was pitching that day. I'm almost certain of this. Connor Jackson comes up to his last at-bat. He needs a double for the cycle. We're winning like 9-1. The game's over. We're winning like 9-1. He's already done everything but the double. He hits a missile off that tall center field wall in Arizona and goes for a triple. Okay, we're in the third base dugout, Arizona, our home dugout, third base. He's coming to third. I'm like, Chip Hale's the third base coach. I'm going to ask Chip Hale about this. I got my hands up as Connor's running to third. Like, don't go to third, bro. What are you doing? He slides into third. He slides into third, looks in the dugout. He's all hype. I got my head in my hands, like the face plant emoji. Connor, what are you doing? What are you doing? He comes in the dugout. I borderline chew him out. I'm like, dude, you just could have had the cycle. He's like, yeah, but dude, two triples in a game is awesome. I'm like, no, it's not. Not if you need the cycle. It's not. Nobody cares about two triples in a game. What are you? So we had this big laugh about it. Well, fast forward 20 years later, and a buddy of mine is in Scottsdale, and him and Connor are having a beer, and he sends me a text. I'm with your buddy, Connor Jackson. I'm like, I haven't talked to Connor Jackson in 17 years. He's like, we started talking. He told me, blah, 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 blah. Your name came up. I'm like, ask him if he still regrets going for his second triple. And he's like, he texts back like, you're never going to let me live that down. I'm like, no, I'm not ever, not ever, ever, ever. So.
Well, I got to say, Berkey, we got to cut you off here, but you nailed every detail of this one. April 18th, 2008, Greg Maddux, for some reason, pitches seven
just
innings, even though
it.
He's getting blasted. just wearing it at like
days,
42
baby.
Years old. This is, 42-year-old Greg Maddux just throwing 113 pitches.
And Connor Jackson, what did he go for that day?
Four for five with a single.
What are you doing,
two triples
Connor? What are you doing? They don't put that in the media guide. Like you don't make the list.
Yeah, this is probably one of Greg Maddux's worst games of his career. Now,
that's
again,
right.
Not judging him by it because he
good
was
player.
One of the greatest ever. But 13 hits over seven innings with 9 runs is not great. And a career
way
day
to go,
to Connor.
Connor. It was
Jackson,
a great slugging percentage day. You did get an extra total base. So good job.
That's true. That's true.
It counts
that's
in arbitration. Right, some smart man told me that once.
There you go. Chris Burke, we can watch you on the broadcast at ESPN during the College World Series. Thank you so much for giving us these incredible stories and insight into the wide world of college baseball and beyond.
Yeah, hopefully let's do it again. Appreciate you guys having me.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. It is the end of this episode, but it is the beautiful beginning of a big league career. For one, Mr. Roman Anthony, who was called up, God, about damn time, called up on Tuesday for his Major League Baseball debut, MLB's top prospect. Number one, pretty much consensus. Number one, Boston Red Sox bring him up to Fenway. Goes hitless in his first game, notches his first hit last night on Tuesday. And let's talk about Roman Anthony. Oh, I apologize. Debut was on Monday. Debuted on Monday after we recorded. Played Monday night. Bad Monday night. Bad. Not fair. Tuesday, first hit. Here we are.
Yeah, you know, had a not-so-awesome defensive moment there on Monday. But that's the Red Sox. So you know, he's not alone. It's not like he came up to the best defensive team in baseball and made an error. Roman Anthony, who is this? Who's this guy? He is the new youngest player in baseball. So congratulations to him. He is a couple months younger than Jackson Chourio, who has already been in the big leagues for a year plus.
So, you know, I'm a huge cycling dork. And in cycling, different guys wear different types of jerseys that are slightly different to indicate certain accomplishments. Usually, like if you are the Belgian champion, you get to wear like a Belgian jersey with your team logo on it and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. We should have like a different color hat or wristband or patch for the active youngest and oldest players.
And oldest. Yeah.
It should be like a little cartoon of a baby and like a little cartoon of a grandpa. And they should have that patch on their uniform as long as they're the oldest or youngest.
Yeah. Well, right. Chourio finally giving it up. Yep. As we have our second 2004 baby to make it to the big leagues. And Roman Anthony, who did just turn 21 last month, is now, we should say, I mean, seemed like his call up was going to be coming soon. It did coincide with Willy Abreu getting injured. I don't know. We kind of needed that to happen, right? We've been talking about the Red Sox roster being a logjam all season and just a weird mess to work with. Not that it's a good thing that Willy Abreu was hurt, but it did create a more natural opening that they truly could not ignore. But why is Roman Anthony important? Why is he special? Why was he the top prospect in baseball? He swings the bat really fast and hits the ball really hard. Now, that's a simplification of it, but when you consider what he was doing in the minor leagues as the youngest or one of the youngest players at every level, he did not come out of nowhere in the way that, you know, Christian Campbell did, right? If you compare him to his other two, you know, big three Red Sox prospects, he's much closer to Marcelo Meyer. Now, he was not a first round pick like Marcelo Meyer, but Roman Anthony was well known as a high schooler in Florida. And really what happened with him was his summer before his senior year was just not awesome. Everybody knew who he was. And so there were a lot of scouts kind of bearing down on him. And his spring was pretty good, you know, playing against good competition in South Florida. But it was enough for a guy who projected at the time to be a corner outfielder, first baseman. He was a little stiff, where it was like, I mean, there's some offensive talent here, but if you're not hitting that much on the showcase circuit, like, we're not that excited. Red Sox stayed on him, paid him a lot of money in the second round. And pretty quickly in pro ball, it was like, oh, like, this was the Roman Anthony we were excited about, you know, when he was an underclassman. There's clearly more kind of explosive offensive ability. He was not as stiff. And then suddenly now he's playing some center field. And, you know, the numbers kind of speak for themselves. And he just combines an incredible amount of raw power with an impressive aptitude, you know, isn't striking out a lot, is drawing walks. It's kind of the complete package offensively, other than that he does hit a lot of ground balls, but he's hitting it so hard that the production has still been there, even with like a 50% ground ball rate. So it's a pretty standard, like, it's not something we've never seen before in terms of comps. Christian Yelich is one, if you're going on the high end, certainly in terms of, you know, the power production when we saw Yelich's peak. You could look at some other corner outfielders that are kind of like that. Maybe we see him play center at some point, although it seems super unlikely as long as Rafaela is around. Again, it's not like a, you know, mold breaking player that we've never seen before. It's just a guy who's very advanced, was crushing at every level, and is now going to have an opportunity to be a good big league hitter right away.
From Roman Anthony to a player who has already achieved a great deal, Shohei Ohtani pitched again yesterday. And if you're sick of us talking about it every time Shohei Ohtani picks up a baseball and throws it, well, I promise you, this one's a little different. For a long time now, the understanding about Ohtani's return to the mound has centered around a post-All-Star break timeline. And for the first time, that seems to be at least a little bit up in the air in a positive way. Yesterday, Dodgers manager Dave Roberts said that the chances are, quote, north of zero that Ohtani could pitch in a big league game before next month's All-Star break. That is from Fab's Fabian Ardaya of The Athletic. Quote, it certainly doesn't have to be full buildup because anything he can give us is certainly additive, Roberts said. I think that's very revealing. The Dodgers have reached a point where they're watching Ohtani throw live BPs and they're like, okay, yeah, he's only doing two or three innings worth. We need pitchers. Like, why not just put him in a game? Like, even 90% of Ohtani is one of the better pitchers on a banged up Dodgers roster.
certainly better than whatever we saw on Tuesday, which was
a sham.
Dodgers win a great, very fun game on Monday night, and then essentially punt on Tuesday. They have Matt Sauer throw like 111 pitches, which
so
is outrageous. And Trevino started.
I want to talk about when you say punt. Teams are always half punting. Okay. They're not, and punting is maybe not the way to describe it. Teams are putting their eggs into certain games' baskets. This is like true of every 100%. Contending team all year, all the time. It's most true when it comes to pitcher usage and reliever and bullpen rest, because if you threw your best reliever every day that you needed them, they would explode by August, right? So you there's a give and take. The Dodgers have been a culprit of this even more so than usual this year as they wade through this barrage of pitcher injuries. But what they did last night feels like it went above and beyond. They started Lou Trevino, and he was an opener. He threw one inning. They then brought in Matt Sauer, who has been something of a bulk guy for them, but not really like your traditional post-opener type arm. And they had him post the following line. 4 2/3 innings, 13 hits, 9 runs, all earned, 3 walks, 6 Ks, and a homer. He threw 111 pitches. You have sack bumps. You have sack flies. This was a sack lamb. The sacrificial lamb, Matt Sauer, went out there and he wore it. And that is a thing that happens sometimes. Guys go out and they wear it for the bullpen. But the Dodgers bringing Kike Hernandez in as a position player to pitch in the 6th inning of a game against your biggest division rival, it makes sense why the Dodgers would do this. I'm not like blaming them from a strategic standpoint. And maybe this is an outlier situation. But like, if I'm buying a ticket to that game, I'm not seeing the product that I paid for.
Well, if you're the Padres fan, you don't care. You're kicking the Dodgers' ass either way. But yes, no, I agree with you.
There's an element of this that just feels hollow to me. I feel like, not that I feel robbed, but it just feels cheap. It's like, I know the NBA has a much bigger problem with this, right?
Way bigger. Yeah.
Way bigger.
This is so. So maybe if you're hard to get too worked up,
you're like, Jake, shut the hell up.
Sure.
But this feels like some of the most blatant punting that we have seen in this sport in a long time.
Sure. I don't disagree. Let's get back to Ohtani. Two important Ohtani things.
Good player.
The first thing is that by all accounts, and especially with this 44-pitch live BP yesterday, the dude looks pretty good. That's not surprising because, one, he's one of the best pitchers in the world. We know that. Two, it's been a really long time since he's pitched. That can be viewed as a bad thing because that's, oh, wow, he hasn't pitched and competed. The other thing is that he's so far removed from elbow surgery at this point that physically, once you account for the fact that, yes, he's hitting every night and doing all these other absurd things that we've never seen before, if you are just focusing on his elbow rehab, he is well past what is normally considered when you would expect a pitcher to be back. So it does not surprise me at all, for as slow as they've played this, that Ohtani at this stage is looking like Shohei Ohtani, the badass pitcher. When you combine that with a very important part of this, which we will start to talk about more, and I don't think we've talked about that much during the season, which is that he is considered a two-way player. Why is that important? That is an official designation on the roster. Why is that important? You are only allowed to have 13 pitchers on your roster. But Shohei doesn't count. And so the notion, when we talked about, okay, if Ohtani's going to come back, but he's not ready to give you a full start, in normal situations, that would be a hindrance on your roster management because one of your 13 pitchers who's a starter can only go so many innings. But if Shohei doesn't count as that, you don't have to worry about that. You still have your full staff. And if he's only throwing 3-4 innings for the first few weeks, that's fine. Also, the other thing about this is what we were already just talking about. The Dodgers are already managing around a limited pitching staff. And if any team is going to figure out a way to maneuver the roster to make sure that they can cover enough innings, Yeah. This would be true even if Shohei did count to the 13. But the point is that he's looking good enough now and is looking close enough to be ready to give them 3 to 4 good innings, maybe in the next few weeks, that it does not surprise me that they have reached this stage. And I'm excited to see it because, back to my first point, he's one of the best pitchers in the world. And it does not surprise me that this many months removed from surgery, he's looking like that again. So it does not remove the wonder of the fact that he is also hitting all these home runs and is that same person. But it does. It is a reminder that, like, yes, this is a pitcher you would want to get back sooner rather than later. And I expect to see it.
That's it. That's our episode. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Chris Burke for guesting and dealing with me making up him playing for two big league teams that he didn't play for. Good job, Jake. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing this episode. Thank you to you, Jordan, for doing it with me. You are out on Friday. Russ Dorsey will be pinch hitting for you. That is good. And I'm excited to go to Omaha next week. It's going to be a great time.
Ooh, I'm going to the MLB Draft Combine. We got more amateur baseball talk on the way. Thank you all for listening. Email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. I will talk to you next week. You will talk to Jake. You will hear from Jake and Russ Dorsey on Friday. Bye-bye.